Welcome to another life-changing message preached live at Hope City Church. We hope you'll be encouraged and inspired by God's word to live your best life yet. So get ready to hear from God as you enjoy the message.
Awesome. You can take your seats. Get your notepads out or your flicky things. Make yourself comfortable. I'm not going to take any more time. I want you to give a massive round of applause to our friends, Mr. Stewart. Here he comes.
Hello. Wow. I am in Liverpool. That's unbelievable. You can take your seats, guys. It's unbelievable, Liverpool. It's been 10 years, this journey that I will talk about today. It's been 10 years in the unfolding. But I see a lot of, well, I don't see a lot of faces because it's quite dark at the back, actually. I can't see anyone. But at the front, I can see a lot of people who I started that journey with, who are still here. That just today fills me with just such, I don't know. It's just, you start off on a journey that you don't know where it's going. You don't know what's going to happen. But there's people around this room that have seen like me at my worst and are now seeing what God's done and have done that journey with me. It just encourages me so much that we don't do this thing alone. And I don't want to get too deep too quick, but I just think that's just outstanding that there's people who I could just talk to any of these, to Gary, to Andy and Alex, to any of these people, to Alan at the back there. They know my journey. They know me. And so today, I think maybe a little bit of an eye-opener because I'm probably going to go into a bit more detail than I ever did with them in the past. Because I think time gives you the ability to do that. Time closes wounds and it heals things up. And there's lots of stuff that went on previously to me coming into this place that made me who I am, but actually caused huge wounds in my life. But today I'm able to stand here in Liverpool and talk about it. And that's unbelievable. I just, let's come on. Let's give God a round of applause because it's outstanding. But I, it's amazing to be here. I'm an Evertonian because I am a true Scouser. Oh, brilliant. Put it back on. Obviously, that's a Londoner at the back who supports Liverpool. Brilliant. But but no, it's great to be here in Liverpool. And I'm just gonna go on. I don't want to ramble too much because I've got a lot to say and I haven't got a massive amount of time. So I'm gonna go straight into it. But I was born in this city. I was born not too far from here in Fazakerley, so it's that way somewhere. But basically, I grew up in a great family. My mum and dad are awesome people. They were Christians, so I grew up in a really good household, really sort of safe environment, and loved it. Life was brilliant. I'm a Scouser. I'm proud of it. I love this city. I love its heritage. Grew up with my family really being proud Scousers, and so, really happy family. There were signs early on when I was about 8 that there was maybe some things mentally not fully right with me. When one day at school, I attacked somebody because they were calling me the FA Cup. Now, I'll explain that a little bit because what happened was when I was younger, I was born with the unfortunate problem of having ears like Dumbo the elephant. They literally stuck out like this. They were massive. And so everybody used to skip me, used to call me names. And one day, basically, this guy, after 3 months of calling me the FA Cup and picking me up by my ears and running around the playground with me, I lost my temper with him. And I jumped on him. And as I fell on the floor on top of him, I just smashed his head into the ground. And I remember thinking, this is the 8 years of age, I'm not going to stop until you stop moving. I want you not to move. And this is 8 years of age. I'm just going to grab a drink of water. I'm going to explain this as well because this will help. I have a lot of medication I'll talk about later because of a health condition that I've got. And so when I talk, not just in these kind of situations, but just one-to-ones, I get terribly dry mouth. And what happens is my lips stick to my teeth. And so I end up looking down like this, looking like that. The kids, actually, I'll just say, my wife and I, we're the WizKids pastors over in Sheffield. And so we work with the 5 to 11s. And the kids call me the Gruffalo. One, because they say I'm big and fat and look like the Gruffalo. But two, because when I do talk, my teeth stick out and I got terrible husks, apparently. So that's why they call me the Gruffalo. But yeah, where was I? Yeah, so I'm smashing his head on the ground. And I'm saying, I don't want you to move. I don't want you to get up. And that's what I'm thinking in my mind. And so later on, the teachers all have this meeting, this crisis meeting, and get my parents in and say, you know, we think we need to get him to see an educational psychologist because there's something not quite right. So they get me to see an educational psychologist who, brilliant advice, say to my mum and dad, get his ears pinned back. That'll help him. So my mum and dad get my ears pinned back. And so I go from being called the FA Cup to being called Dr. Spock. But that's all right, because now I quite like Star Trek, so I wasn't too concerned about that. So basically, that fixed the problem. But there was just a little indication there that for me, there was a bit of an anger issue. There was a little bit of a problem. And so at the age of 12, after sort of like getting into a little bit of gang stuff with friends, just sort of stealing and a little bit of robbery and theft and stuff, my mum and dad decided that they needed to channel a little bit of my energy. And so they sent me to like kickboxing lessons. So I went to started doing kickboxing, which is a great way to give someone with a history of violence and setting them up for life. Send them to kickboxing, it's brilliant. But actually, it didn't really work. It sort of settled me down, gave me discipline, and I loved it. I really got into it. Really sort of like came quite proficient and just loved what I was doing. And then sort of like from the age of 12 to 16. Just really got into that. That was my life. I was training, you know, sort of like going to training 2-3 times a week and sort of competing and stuff at junior level. And then at the age of 16, because I was born in, as I say, a Christian household, I was still sort of like going to church and you know, trying to work that out. But obviously, and this is why I'm really happy that the Ignite guys are in today, because at that age, between sort of like 12 to 16, you're faced with a lot of challenges and a lot of peer pressure and a lot of issues that sort of like there's other things that are going on that are all vying for your attention. And so when you're in church and you are a church kid, it's expected from your parents and the people around that church is just the thing that you do. It's what you do. It's what you know. It's the only thing you know. But for me, because I was always mixing with these other kids and I was always outside of church, you know, there was other stuff going on. It wasn't just a clear-cut choice for me. And so I always had this real sort of, like, it was an argument going on internally. I knew God. I loved God. I loved church. But actually, I didn't want to be there. I felt like I wanted to be outside. I wanted to make my own choices. And so at the age of 16, my mum and dad gave me the choice of whether I continued to go to church or whether I stopped and started continuing to go to kickboxing. So I did that and just walked away from church, just left it. Didn't at the time give any thought to it. Obviously, years later, come to that to be a really regretful decision. But obviously, also a decision in terms of, for me, it was the best thing that happened because after all the stuff which I'll talk about today, I actually made a decision to know God that was mine, that was real, that was for me. And so, you know, I say that not to encourage anyone in this room to go away from God, but I say that to say, look, there's nothing more important than getting your own relationship with God. That's sustainable, that will continue, that will hold you. And the fact is that all of that stuff that I went through, all it did is it proved to me that God's ever more real than what my parents told me, because it's my experience. But if I could tell you that today, God is so real. He loves you so much. He's got such a plan for you guys. You know, but these years between sort of like 9 to 16 especially, you know, listen to the people who are around you, listen to the advice, because obviously, you know, like today, if I could say anything, it would be God will get you through everything. That would be the one thing. Ah, awesome. Water is brilliant when you've got a dry mouth. It is so good. But so at the age of 16, I just continued into sort of kickboxing. And then by the time 18 came, I kept seeing these guys come into the gym, and they were always in different sort of clothes, different cars. And it was always, it was really interesting to me because it was never really materialistic. But obviously, you're looking at people and you're thinking, oh, that's quite interesting. I wonder where you got that from or why you've got that. I wouldn't mind a little bit of that. I quite like that. So one day I just went up to one of the guys who I knew quite well from sparring, and I just asked him, like, how have you got a different car every week? And so he just explained that he was a doorman, he was working in town, and one of his uncles owned a security firm, And that was, he was earning sort of £100 a night, and he could do that sort of three times a week, four times a week on top of his normal job. So he had a little bit of extra money. And so he was like, yeah, I could get you in if you want, if you're interested. So I was, yeah, everyone wants to make a bit of extra money. So at the age of 18, I started doing door work. It's quite a shame, actually, because where you guys normally meet in the Epstein Theatre, just literally over the road, like spitting distance, like you could literally spit to it. There's a bar called O'Neill's. This isn't that too far, and that's my very first place where I did with the door. The door. So I was really looking forward to being there. And I'm like, you're in the Hilton. Oh, okay. Oh, brilliant. That's great. This place is brilliant. So I started doing door work and loved it. It felt like a fit for me. It felt really, there was a camaraderie between the people that I was working with. And it wasn't sort of, you get this impression that it's sort of, you know, all you do is bash people and throw them out of the club. And there were times when it was like that. But on the whole, when I first started, it was just about sort of, you know, making people have as fun a night as they could, you know, facilitating a fun time, making people safe. That's how it started. And I got into that world really quickly. But the time when I'd come into that was around 1995. And so in Liverpool, it was quite, what had just happened, there was an explosion with a lot of the dance sort of, the dance culture, and the clubs like Cream and some of those are the big sort of like Ministry of Sound had just really exploded, really taken off. And so what came with that in Liverpool was an explosion in drug trade as well, because obviously people were going clubbing and they were taking drugs. And so Liverpool just got washed like with ecstasy and cocaine and all of those kinds of fun time drugs. And the people who were distributing it, the easiest way to make access was the doorman, because they were the people who were securing, you know, doing the security, and they were doing the admissions of people and stuff. So the easiest way was for us to be the people who sold drugs. And very quickly, people saw that there was a lot of money to be made. And in the first year that I did it, there was 44 people were shot. I don't know how many of them were killed, but what comes along with drugs comes violence and comes aggression and comes, you know, territorial sort of battles and stuff. And so what started out as quite a nice, enjoyable little way of, you know, making a few extra pounds quite quickly turned into something that I never expected, and I'm in the middle of a war, pretty much. Maybe 6 months into that, the guy who I was working for, who was my friend's uncle, one day just came in and said, "I'm quitting. I'm going. I'm leaving the company. I'm just getting out." And it turns out he'd been bullied into leaving. And a guy took over who is a well-known figure in the underworld in Liverpool. He took over the door and so took over all of the security guys with him. And so I went with that move and got to know the guy over quite a short space of time. But quite quickly, I don't know what it was, whether he'd seen something in me that was sort of, I don't know, he thought he could sort of groom and mature into a full-blooded hoodlum. I don't know what it was, but he very quickly sort of like he pulled me in and got give me you know, just a few extra sort of jobs on the side, things like just debt collecting and things like that. And so I would very regularly we'd rock up at someone's house and we would you know, back in those days, violence was, it was the first option, especially for if in terms of like as a doorman. It got licensed a few years later, and so everything was very much sort of like you had to do it the way that the policies tell you and stuff. But when I first started, it wasn't like that. It was usually discretion. If someone needs a beating, then you give them a beating. And so that was the kind of that was then the mentality that I was just getting more and more into. And so when we're doing these the debt collecting and we're knocking on people's doors, the first thought wasn't, you know, oh, let's talk you around. The first thought was, you owe money, smack, and then take the money off them. And that just turned into, it got out of hand really quickly. And so we were within sort of like 4 or 5 months of doing my first one, we were just regularly, we were torturing people. We would rock up and we would put blades under people's fingernails to make them give money. There's an incident, I won't go into too much detail, but there's instances where I've stabbed people and just all kinds of stuff. But I've gone from just being on a door to all of a sudden I'm torturing people. And this is just within a space of, I don't know, 8 months. And so as you can see, it's a really slippery slope that I'm on really quickly. And I hadn't even taken drugs myself at that point. I was just selling them. And so, you know, basically, world started spiraling a little bit out of control, started taking some of the drugs that I was selling. And by the time that I was sort of like 19, I was probably doing £300-400 worth of cocaine a week, just really quickly, just everything spiraling out of control. And then I met a girl, which this is quite a strange sort of like twist in the story, because at the same time, I was always quite clever. I was always thinking of ways to, how can I go under the radar? Like, how can I, like, I know that this is sort of like something that's very visible, but how can I go under the radar? And so I'd sort of started a job, I don't know, when I was 18, just every now and again doing some care work for people with autism, just as a, like, it's a good way in. But, like, thinking in my head, this is a real good cover for what, you know, for, so I'm now, I'm a social worker, a residential social worker in the daytime, working with people with autism. And in the nighttime, I'm going out and I'm extorting money from people by stabbing them. It's just crazy, crazy lifestyle. And that just got worse. They put me on a social worker's course to become a registered social worker. And so I was doing that as well. And so, you know, by the time I'd qualified, I'm sort of like, I'm doing mental health as well was the stream that I was doing. So, you know, I'm qualified, able to section people who are mental. And then I'm being more mental than anyone I've ever sectioned in the night. So it was crazy, just a crazy life. And then I met Kelly when I was sort of, like I say, was like 19. And we just, really quickly, it just became a relationship where we just, you know, I thought we'd fallen in love. I thought that's what it was. And we moved in together really quickly. And then we were married within, I don't know, maybe a year or so. And everything seemed fine. I need to find a better way. I think I need to get one of those hats that's got, like, straws on it. That's what I need. We after, I don't know, 6 months of marriage, things just started not being right. We were just little bits of tension, little bits of arguments. And obviously it's because we didn't know each other at all, really. And then just one day, my sister was a nurse in an A&E department. And I got a telephone call from her just saying, you need to come to the hospital. Kelly's just been admitted. And so I got to the hospital, and she'd taken, I think, maybe 60 paracetamol, and she'd sort of like slit her wrists, and she had cuts all over her body and stuff. And basically what had happened was something had happened in the process of us getting married to that point, where something had just snapped in her, and she decided she didn't want to live anymore. She just wanted to take her life, and she didn't want to be around. And so we started seeing psychiatrists and, you know, the crisis team and stuff. And they quickly diagnosed her with a bipolar disorder, but also with a psychotic condition, which basically meant she needed treatment to treat that. Otherwise, she would just continue to want to end her life. And so just this whole process just continued, and things were just, I could never trust her almost. It was like I was just so wanting constantly to be around her that I dropped everything else and just became so insecure about who I was, about who we were, and just the fact that I wasn't able to do anything about her. And so really just that was just messing me up completely. And so I say that in detail because, you know, we are in the month of November, which is, you know, across Hope City Church, we're believing for something supernatural. And I really believe in this room, people have experienced mental health, or people have, right now, the family members who are experiencing issues with mental health. And I know that it doesn't just affect the person who has the condition, it affects families, it affects friends, it affects relationships. And I really believe in that in this month of November, that there's a real breakthrough in the area of mental health. And I say that because obviously at the end we'll give people an opportunity to pray, but and to really let God do some work in that. But I just really believe right now that there's people here under the sound of my voice, and I just really believe there's release today, and there's freedom today from those issues. So things have just spiraled out of control, and we had decided, Kelly and I, that we were just going to just keep plodding on and keep trying to make this thing work. But the worst things got a home. the more things got out of control outside. And so I was just going out to work overnight time, just full of anger. And, you know, the people who I would come in touch with in the club would pay for that. And so I was now just smashing people for no reason and just hitting people as my first form of defence, rather than sort of like trying to talk situations down. And so things were just like crazy, just really, really out of control. And then I found, one morning, I found a text message on Kelly's phone, and it was from, I thought it was from another person, another guy. And basically, long story short, she'd been having an affair, and the reason why was because she felt that I wasn't able to give her the love that she needed, and so all these things are just absolutely crazy. And so we decided that's it. Well, I decided that's it. Marriage is over. Kicked her out. Sent her off. But being who I was, that wasn't enough for me. And so I'd got the mobile number of the person who was on the other end of the telephone, and I had arranged for a couple of my friends to pay a visit to them. Now, they lived in Newcastle. We tracked it back. I had a friend at the time who worked for the Crown Prosecution Service, who was able to track and trace phone numbers, and sent guys to see to this guy in Newcastle. And so I'm there, and I'm on the phone. It's 11 o'clock in the morning, and I remember it vividly. I remember my friend Albie, who was like my partner in crime and everything I did. He called me and said, right, we're out. There's three of us. We're ready to go. She's just walked out of the house. We'll go for it now. So I was like, yeah, go for it. And then he was like, oh, hang on. We can't. And so I'm like, what are you on about? Just go and smash him. Just go and do it now. Just that's what you're there for. Just go and do it. And he's like, Stu, you know that guy that you sent us here for? It's not a guy, it's a girl. And so it turned out that she was having an affair with another woman, and she felt like that she couldn't sort of, I don't know, she could never trust another man again. And so things were just crazy. Now, when you're a doorman and you're doing the things that I was doing, your pride really hurts when things are, certain buttons are pressed. And to have another woman be the cause of your relationship, in terms of this is how I was thinking, be the cause of your relationship breaking. It's just there, and especially when you sent three of your best known friends who are huge guys who you know are going to take the mickey out of you for years about it. And so I am just freaking, you know, I'm just like so angry that this whole thing has happened. And so I just went on a binge for, I don't know, for maybe four or five weeks of just constantly taking cocaine, ecstasy, and just got into a right old state. And then one night, I sort of like, I was on the other side of it, starting to feel a bit better, but still just like really needing to sort of like, I don't know, just there was almost like, it felt like I needed to get this anger out some way. I needed one episode just to get it out and to move forward. And there'd been a guy who'd been coming into the club that I was working on regularly, and he'd been trying to muscle in on the drug dealing that we were doing in there. And he had a gang of a few guys. He was only a young guy himself, but he'd seen an opportunity and he was trying to force his way in. And so I'd had many occurrences where I'd sort of like had to deal with this issue with him. But this one night he came in and he was doing it again. He was goading me all night, looking at me, laughing at me and stuff. I was the head doorman at this time, so I was the point of his, you know, his focus. And so I decided this was the way I was going to get past this issue. I'm going to take all of my aggression out on this guy. And so me and three other guys, I'd ordered them to come and grab him. We took him outside. We smashed his head on every single door, opened the door on the way. But I can remember thinking in my head, back to that what I thought when I was eight, when I was thinking, I don't want you to stop moving. I want you to be completely still. And not knowing what that meant, but just knowing that I just wanted him to not move, to not say anything, to not move, you know, to just be still. So we took him out into the courtyard, and we just beat him. We just beat him till he wasn't moving anymore. And we were just kicking him and stamping him. And I remember him being on the floor, lying, like just prostrate, not moving. And then I just, without thinking, just brought my foot back and just kicked him in the head. And all of a sudden, instantly, we started seeing blood coming down from his ear. And I remember thinking, I've killed him. Like, he's dead. He wasn't moving. And so we decided we'd just get him out, put him out on the street. And we got sent home. And I didn't know what at that time, I can't remember what I thought. I can't remember thinking, to be honest, in the space. But the next thing I remember is probably the next morning, about 8 o'clock, getting woken up by the CID. We're on outside my front door with some plainclothes police officers and some officers as well. And I was arrested for a charge of attempted murder. So I was taken into custody, and obviously sort of, basically they said that they had witnesses and there was CCTV footage and stuff. And so I'm now thinking that's it, I'm done. And still waiting on the outcome of whether if he lived or if he didn't live, not knowing what the charge would be, whether it would be a murder charge or attempted murder or what. But just knowing, right, instantly there was just this feeling of like, I don't know, there's a connection of something that switched on where my life's got to change. And it wasn't just that I'd have been involved in this incident. It was almost like the whole build-up of everything from the past sort of 2 or 3 years, just in that one moment, just hit me to show me that if I didn't change, my life's just going to, you know, prison or death are probably the two possible outcomes. And so I just decided that I had to let this play out, however it played out. If it meant I was going to be in jail for for a long time, then that was going to be how it was. But just being quite, yeah, we'll see. Not blasé, but just confident, just calm. I didn't know then, but I know now that was it. That was God already starting to minister to me, already starting to put his peace into me. But then 4 weeks after that, I was on remand, so I was refused bail. I had to stay in because of the nature of the crime. And so 4 weeks later, I just got a visit from my barrister, who it was the brief, who just came and said, look, the charges have been dropped. Basically what's happened is the witnesses have all, they've removed their witness statements. They're not going to testify against you anymore, which basically means we don't have a case because the CCTV footage, which we thought we had, isn't enough evidence on its own to convict. And so under British law, that's classed as, I'd gone through the process of the you know, being prosecuted over it, but I was released and found not guilty. And basically I was out within a day. I was out and they released me, and I was home. And it was crazy because I hadn't even told my parents any of this. My mum and dad think still probably to this day, because I've never had a conversation about this specific moment. But they thought I was on a 4 week holiday. They didn't know where I was. I hadn't even told them. I'd managed to be such a good juggler of who I was that I was able to live a completely separate life. My mum and dad didn't know I was a doormat, but they didn't know what I was doing or any of this stuff. And so I'd got out, I had my freedom all of a sudden, but not really knowing what freedom meant, you know, thinking our freedom is sort of like I'm out and I'm able to do something different. It wasn't until many years later that I got a true understanding of what the word freedom really means. You know, I think we tend to think that freedom is that something that we're just free from. You know, like I did at that moment in time. You know, I got out of prison and I'm free from prison and that's it. But the thing with God and the thing with true freedom is that the fact is you're not just free from something. God gives you freedom from when you are free to then go and do something. It's a double-sided coin. So you're free from, I was free from something, but I never realized actually that then I was free to go and change my life and do something differently, because I always thought it was about me. And so at that point I'm struggling and I'm trying to change things but not realizing that actually you've got to give it to God. There's no other way that you can get through these things other than God. And I found a path to that, you know, eventually. But the next 2 years after being released, you know, I wanted to change, and I stopped doing door work, and I occasionally sort of like stopped selling drugs and stopped taking drugs, just trying to sort of like change my life. But realizing that actually on my own, nothing's really going to stick. So it was, I could have a go at it, I could have a run at it, but it'd never stick. I'd always sort of like end up reverting back to type. And so there was a point where, you know, after trying so long and trying so hard to change, again, I just started to become quite, I don't know, I suppose quite paranoid, and my own mental health, I suppose, was starting to suffer. And I just got back into it, doing sort of like a little bit of door work again, and just because I couldn't sustain it on myself, I just kept falling back to type. And so there was this moment where, again, I was just falling back into the way I was, but no one, just desperately asking, and I didn't even, and obviously I'd known God in the past, but because I didn't have a relationship with him, and everything that I knew of God was based on religion, because that's what I'd come from, Everything was based on me not being good enough and me feeling like there's no way I can change. I can't do it, so I'm just going to have to carry on in this way because God can't do anything because I'm too bad. I've done too much stuff. God can't forgive me. And so I remember one night from that point, I think it was sort of like, I don't know, maybe, I don't know. It was like, I think it was a Saturday night. Yeah, it was a Saturday night. And I remember going out and just, I'd taken like two or three ecstasy tablets. And I was just, I'd taken quite a bit of cocaine as well. And I was just, I was happy, but there was something in my spirit and it just wasn't peaceful. It just didn't feel right. And so I'd maybe 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, I thought I need to go home. Got in a taxi, just not too far from here by Norton Street. And I saw a billboard on the side of a building. It was Gary, I don't know if it's still your office now, but it was sort of by the old offices where Gary was, the old ones. And it was a sign for Hope City Church. And I remember just thinking, looking at it and thinking, this is in a state of like, I'm on high on ecstasy and cocaine. I'm thinking, oh, church, oh, that's interesting. I've never seen that sort of advertised in that way before. And then thinking no more of it, but just being odd. There's a church on the side of a billboard. That's odd. And then I sort of got home and went to bed. And about, I don't know, 8 o'clock in the morning, I met the loudest, most real voice I've ever heard, even to this day, still most real voice I've ever heard. And it said, get up and go to that church now. And so I thought I was dancing. I thought, I'm still, this ecstasy is brilliant. This is great. This is a really good ease. These were. I rolled over and tried to get back to sleep. And about half an hour later, I heard exactly the same voice again. Get up and go to that church now. And so I did. I got up and I got on a train and I came into town. And it was when Hope City was meeting the Marriott, right in the centre of the city. And I remember walking in, and please don't take any offence if you were one of these people, but I remember walking in thinking, what a bunch of idiots. What a bunch of absolute losers. Look at them. They're all like got sponge fingers on and they're dancing and they're singing and they're crazy. And I've never met so many happy people. And the fact that they were all happy made me really angry. And so I came in and I sat down and everyone was coming up to me. Hi, how are you? If you ask me one more time, I'll show you how I am. But it was just the strangest place I'd ever been in. And then they started sort of like praise and worshiping. And obviously because of my background in church, I knew about like singing songs to God and stuff. And I'm like, oh, this is weird. This is all right. It's weird. It's all right. It's quite new. It's quite modern. And so I remember just thinking, yeah, we'll go with this. And then at the end, basically, there was a guy called Rob Ray. He used to be the pastor of the Manchester congregation at the time. And he was just talking about how he'd been in prison and he'd had an experience where like he'd felt that God had given him freedom, where he was allowed to be free from everything that he'd done and he was able to move on and move forward. And I just remember thinking, wow, well, if he can have it, maybe that's what I'm missing. Maybe that thing that I've been trying to do myself and trying to change, maybe that's what it is, what he's talking about. And so I put my hand up at the end and I said the prayer. And then at the end, after that, you know, because everyone's so friendly, I remember. And Pastor Andy Gorman, who was the pastor at the time, came running over to me. And he was with a big smile on his face. He's obviously thinking, we've got a real one here, yeah. He comes over and he's like, oh, can I pray with you? And my first words were... one of them began with F, let's just put it that way. and I said, no, I'd like that guy to pray for me. So I asked for Rob to pray for me. Andy is quite insecure still about that to this day. So don't mention it, all right? But so anyway, I got prayed for and I really believed that moment, like something had changed. It felt like, oh, I feel good. This is brilliant. And I remember, you know, going to the next thing was on a Wednesday night. And I remember thinking, oh, I'm going to go straight to this. And it was Siobhan, I think, was Wednesday Night Live. I remember thinking, whoa, who is this female Hitler? This isn't, like, she's got something. This is awesome. Like, if she can talk like that, this is brilliant. So there's just something just inside these people just grabbed me. It wasn't just the experience I felt with God, but it was something about the people that really just, I was like, oh, this is like, maybe there's something here. And so the next few weeks and months, I just came to church and, you know, Sundays, I was loving it. Mondays, I was, you know, still dealing drugs and still, you know, occasionally hitting people and stuff. Not for too long, but I was still doing it. Nick and Jono, wherever they are, they're over there, they'll testify to this. When they started coming over to my house, they came over to from Sheffield to Liverpool to help really steer stuff. They used to stay in my flat, and I remember, like, one day, Nick found the remnants of how my life used to be and still was when she found that. I think, was it a hammer or a machete or an axe or something? A crowbar. There was stuff everywhere. I had knives in every drawer. I had crowbars. I had a machete under my bed. I had a samurai sword in the toilet. I had a gun in there. Honestly, it was ridiculous. And Nick's like, you know, what's this? What? But that's just what life was like. And I remember, you know, between Monday to Sunday, just my life hadn't really changed. And I remember thinking, like, if this is real, it can't just be about one day. There's got to be something, you know, about my life. And so I remember just thinking, I'm just going to stick with this. I could have very easily given up because I'm thinking, what's going on? And then I went to Phil. You can come up if you want. That would be awesome. I'm just about to land it, so if you want to, that'd be awesome. But you don't have to. You can say something there. Keys. I went to a conference. It was Audacious Conference. I remember thinking, this is a great story, honestly. I love this story. I remember thinking, I'll go. Everyone's asking me to go. And so I'm thinking, because I've never been to a Christian concert or conference before, my view of what this is a concert. I can sell drugs at this concert. There's kids, there's youth, there's young people at this concert. I'm going to go. So anyway, I get ready, and I'm in church that day, and Pastor Beth, who's now the lead pastor in Sheffield, had agreed to drive me over to Sheffield with her. And so basically, I get in a car with £2,500 worth of cocaine and ecstasy in my pocket to sell at Audacious. It was a rubbish concert. No, it was an amazing conference, honestly. I got there and I was like, just looked around, and I was in the ice rink, and I remember thinking, oh, this is amazing. And the night time, there's a guy called Mark Ritchie preaching. I don't know if any of you guys know him, but Mark Ritchie's a legend. He's an evangelist, and he preaches about the cross a lot. And he was just talking that night about how the cross can set you free, but you're not just free, you're free indeed. And I love that Bible verse now, but at the time, I didn't realize the significance of it. And I remember him just saying at the end, if you really want freedom in this place, you want to be free of everything, just come down to the front. And I ran down to the front, and I remember just almost like this, like someone had come behind me and just kicked the knees from underneath me and just fallen onto my knees, fallen onto the floor, with the cocaine and ecstasy still bulging in my pocket. And just really knowing that this is the moment that my life's about to change forever, because it's not about me. And the reason why I knew that is because I couldn't think the thoughts that I was thinking at that time of a future, of seeing myself completely clean, completely like I am now, talking to people about what God's doing, completely happy in my life. I could actually see it at that moment. And I knew that couldn't be me, because I'd never been able to think those things before. You know, and so I remember just, I went into the toilet, excuse me, I still get quite emotional about this now, but I went into the toilet, and I had my Bible with me, and I remember as I walked in, it fell onto the floor, and it fell open, and it was Galatians 5:1, and it just said simply this, it said, it is for freedom that we are set free. I remember just, that moment just took me, it just completely just took my breath away. I'm just thinking, it is for freedom. It was for me for now to go and do something with it. And as I said earlier, it's that double-sided coin that God gives you freedom from something to then go and do something. And so I remember just thinking, I can't miss this opportunity now. I've now got to go and do something with my life and change this thing around. And I went to the toilet and I flushed the drugs down the toilet. Wealth creation all gone down the toilet right there. But just feeling so free and so... just ready for what was next, just ready for what God had planned for me. And so I left that place, and I can honestly say that from that moment on, the spirit within inside me has never been different from that day to this. God's transformation power just hit me, you know, abundantly. And I just love how, if you look back at my life and think of everything that had happened, I just think, how did it all come together? Like, how has that happened? It's not, it can't be coincidence, because there's too many strange things that had happened in it all. How can this all come together? And then the weirdest thing of all happened, and basically, I don't know, 3 months after, I got, you know, I really sort of felt that at Audacious. Decided that I had to write letters to the people that I'd hurt, just as an exercise, because I just felt like I've got to get rid of this, some of this stuff. And it felt quite selfish at the time, but I felt that was okay. I felt like I just had to exercise some stuff. And so I found out from a friend of a friend who, the guy that I'd fractured, basically the guy who I'd kicked and I was arrested for, I'd fractured his skull. And basically what I'd done is I'd caused some slight learning disabilities, and he'd been left with a severe epilepsy, which had completely changed his life. And I remember just thinking, gosh, I've just ruined someone's life completely, and I've got to let him know that I'm so sorry, sincerely so sorry for what I did. And so I wrote a letter to him, and I arranged for my friend who had known from back then to take it to the family, and not expecting to hear anything back, but maybe to expect some, I don't know, repercussions or something, but just felt I had to do it. And so we sent the letter, and then six weeks later I got a reply. And I remember just thinking, because I remember all the time, I've been in church now for maybe 6 to 9 months, and I remember the pastor's always talking about grace, this thing called grace that God gives you, and obviously I'd experienced something because I felt free, but I didn't really know what grace meant or what it was. And I got this letter, and basically what this letter was said, very briefly, it said, look, we knew what he was getting into, he knew what he was getting into, we forgive you, he forgives you. He forgives you. And just being absolutely blown away by this thing called grace and understanding it for the first time. Because grace is something that you don't deserve. I don't deserve it. It's unmerited. It's unmerited favor. So that's what the theologians call it, the unmerited favor of God. It's not about anything that you can do. It's not anything that you can change or that you deserve, but God gives us it all the same. And in this family, like a very notorious family of the underworld in Liverpool, I see this huge exhibition of grace. He forgives you. And then at the end of the letter, in the strangest, scribbliest writing I've ever seen, it just said, P.S. No hard feelings, La. I forgive you. Never want to see you again. But all's forgiven. And it was signed by Joey. And I just remember that absolutely just transforming my thinking on what grace was, and getting that revelation of we all come under that. You know, when God gives us his grace, he doesn't give us it in a half measure, he gives it in a full measure. And you know, today there's people sitting here, and I've been talking about jail bars and cells and all kinds of things, but you know what, there's things in real day-to-day life that are just as real as those jail bars, as those cells that hold us, that confine us, that keep us trapped. You know, there's people here with lots of different issues, you know, financial. You know, there's people who are here with, I just felt before we were talking about supernatural, but I really believe there's people here today with eating disorders. And I just really believe God's saying right now, today is the day for freedom. There's freedom from that today. You don't need to continue in that. You don't need, because it's not about you. It's about what God can do through you and in you. And I just, if anything, if my life and the mess that my life was in to what it is now can speak anything. I mean, the testimony of that is just my beautiful wife here with me today, and how God just changes things around and just puts people in your world that you can do it with, who understand you, who love you. We've got a 2.5 foot little boy who's amazing, Freddie. God can rescue you from anything. So no matter how it feels today, how behind the bars you feel, there's freedom in this place today. And I just really believe that that's for you, that's for every single one of us. And so whatever's going on in your life today, whatever the issues are, I'd love it if just right now, right across this place, with every head bowed and every eye closed, I'd love you just for me, just to pray with you. I'd just love it if you just put your hand in the air right now. Whatever the issues are, whatever's going off in your life, if you need freedom in this place, if you need God's grace in your life, if you just need God to come in and just to rescue you, just a safe place to be, a safe place that you can call home, I want you to just raise your hands right around this place right now. Father God, we lift you up today, Father. We thank you that you are a caring God, that you are a loving Father, that you see us, God, in our true natural sense, Father, and you love us, God. You love us for whoever we are, Father. You take all of the stuff, God, and you just forgive us, God. You give us complete freedom and complete forgiveness. And today, God, I just speak over issues in this place, God. I just speak over issues in this place, God, that are trying to control people and to trying to lock people in, God. And I'm just, right now, Father, in the name of Jesus, we just say, God, freedom in this place, Father. Through the grace of and power of your love, God, we just declare freedom in this place today, God. God, complete freedom. Freedom that has never, ever been thought or imagined, God. Father, because you, as your Bible says in Romans 8:28, Father, you work all things together for good, Father. All things, God. So whatever has happened, God, whatever twisted path that life has taken, God, it's all been because you have chosen it, Father. You have, God, you've predestined it, God. You've called it, God, and today you've released it, Father. There is freedom in this place, Father. Complete freedom. In the name of Jesus. Everybody said, amen. Awesome. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to today's podcast. We'd love to hear how God is working in your life through this ministry. If you've got a story to share, email us at mybestlife@hopecitychurch.tv. And why not join us this weekend for one of our weekend services? For details of a service near you, or for more information about Hope City Church, visit us online at hopecitychurch.tv. See you next time.